Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whatever happened to the dozens of tortured animals rescued from NFL quarterback Michael Vick in 2007? Vick served nearly 2 years in federal prison as punishment for his part in a dogfighting operation run out of his property in rural Virginia. And initially, it appeared that the surviving dogs would face a death sentence of sorts, having been so psychologically scarred they'd remain dangerous forever. Although they took no pleasure in it, even many animal rights activists spoke up in favor of euthanasia. But there were people who believed at least some of the dogs could be saved, and they set about trying to prove on a case-by-case basis that there was still hope for these animals, once kept alive only to fight. Jim Grant is senior editor at Sports Illustrated. He tells the story in his book, The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. It's available now in trade paperback. Jim, welcome to Think.
Glad to be here.
Just as you do in the book, I want to spend much more of this hour talking about the dogs than about their abusers, but perhaps you can set the stage for us by explaining the setup at the Bad News Kennels, which is Vick's property.
Well, it was a 15 acres in rural Virginia, not a lot of folks around there. It's pretty spread out kind of place, and there was a small sliver off the road, and then it opened out into this large wooded area. And initially, there was nothing on this site, but they eventually built a house, a very nice multi-bedroom house there, with a basketball court and a swimming pool and, white picket fence and the whole thing. It looked like just your average sort of semi-suburban home. Mm-hmm. Then beyond that, as you got in the woods, got sort of thicker, there was a second black fence, and behind that, there were four black sheds and a pretty professional concrete kennel with chain link enclosures, and actually has very high end at its own septic system. And then beyond that, deeper into the woods, there were dogs chained up. They actually chained to car axles. The car axles stick out of the ground and allows the chain to sort of rotate around without getting tangled. So what looked like from the front just this average and very nice home. And you went beyond that one level, and there seemed to be some sort of dog-related compound there, and they actually did have a kennel license, and any cover-up story could potentially be that they were running a legitimate kennel service. But then when you went then another layer back into the woods, it was clear this was a dog-fighting operation.
And how were authorities tipped off to the activity taking place on Vick's property?
Ironically, it was a police dog that smelled one night outside a club down in that area. He smelled marijuana in a car, and the police opened up the car, and they found drugs in there. When the person came out to claim the car, he was arrested, and that turned out to be Michael Vick's cousin, who was living with him at the time, and he gave the address of Michael Vick's home, which the police recognized. And there had been rumors about drug situations there and also dogs there, and so they thought this evidence combined with those rumors was enough to get a search warrant. And, they actually went to the property. The original warrant was for a drug search. And once they got there and they saw the evidence of dogfighting, they got a second warrant and then went back and did the dogfighting search and found, obviously, what they found.
And was there some hesitation initially as to whether a big star like Vick should be prosecuted?
I don't know. I know there was... there was a lot of debate about, this was all couched in the terms of whether or not there was sufficient evidence and what they could and could not prove. And there was, things seemed to be moving slowly. A lot of people, especially, sort of animal welfare advocates and observers of the situation, seemed to feel that there was a lot of stalling going on and a lack of progress, that they were concerned. There was some attempt to, either bury it or it was not being handled right, and those were concerns that people had. All the people running the investigation maintained throughout that they were just, doing their job the best they could. So it was a little bit of a stressful situation that unfolded.
So there were 51 dogs found alive on the property when the seizure was finally made.
51 pit bulls, right. There were some other dogs. There was a small pack of hunting beagles, which belonged to somebody else. And those dogs were returned, and a few other dogs, a handful of other dogs. But there were 51 pit bulls, and you know, part of the thing with the other dogs being there was this was all part of the idea that they were running a kennel service. So, you know, those dogs had their own purpose, I suppose. But, yeah, the 51 pit bulls were taken off the property.
And explain for us, if you will, why initially even some animal rights groups, the Humane Society and PETA, said, look, this is incredibly sad, but the best thing to do is to quickly and painlessly euthanize these dogs.
Well, that had been the long-standing policy of both those groups. And, you know, the idea is that there's so many dogs out there in shelters already waiting to be adopted. And, you know, why spend time and resources sheltering and attempting to adopt these particular dogs, which there's very little chance, you know, that that they'll be adoptable and recoverable. And so they thought it was best to just sort of cut the losses and move on and focus on, you know, the other dogs that already existed that were seen as more adoptable.
And obviously these dogs had a very rough history, but pit bulls as a whole have a hard time being adopted in many parts of the country.
Yeah, well, it's the number one shelter dog, you know, which is a combination of there's too many of them, and people are probably a little bit afraid of them. So it's sort of a double whammy for the pit bull out there in the shelter world.
So talk about this, Jim. I mean, dogs have been bred for thousands of years to coexist peacefully with human beings and, for the most part, with other dogs as well. How does one begin to counteract all that evolution in order to create an animal suited for fighting?
Well, I mean, you know, once you get into all these sort of breeding and genetic debates, there's a lot of differing opinions. But as far as I can ascertain, you know, the generally accepted one is that, you know, these particular dogs, they're a combination of what they, on old English farms, what they called bulldogs, which is a lot different when you think of an English bulldog now, those sort of stubby little drooly guys.
Comic dogs,
not,
yeah.
Not that dog. It's a much different dog than that, which was a bigger dog, and it was used for help on the farm. And what they did was actually they would come in and clamp on the nose of a bull or cow, you know, when the farmer wanted to slaughter the animal, and they would hold on to the nose so the farmer could come in and sort of, you know, complete the task. So they were strong dogs, and they had these strong jaws and strong necks that allowed them to hold on like that. And those dogs were later crossbred with some terrier breeds, and terriers are known for having sort of a prey instinct. When they wanted to try and get rid of rats, there were the rat terrier was created, and you know most of these terriers have that instinct to chase animals. They see something run, you know, those are the kind of dogs that are going to go after squirrels and go after cats or whatever they are. So they took these farm dogs, you know, and they crossbred them with these terriers. So now you have these dogs that were very athletic with the strong jaws and strong necks combined with this sort of instinct, this prey instinct. And you know, and that was sort of the evolution of these fighting dogs. You know, and originally they were used in exhibitions where they would put maybe five or six dogs against a bear or five or six dogs against a bull. And, you know, this was entertainment. People would come and watch it. And eventually that was banned, that was outlawed, and so then they started fighting the dogs against each other, and that's, you know, it all sort of evolved from there.
And I guess it takes a lot of early abuse and mistreatment of the animal even to take these dogs that might be strong for fighting and make them want to fight. Most of them they're not born wanting to fight.
You know, yes and no. I mean, you know, any dog, you know, any individual dog, you know, there's a process of socialization, just like there is with people, you know, where, you know, what they're exposed to at an early age, you know, what they recommend for anyone who gets a dog, when you get a puppy, you know, take it out a lot, get it in a lot of different situations, let it meet a lot of different people, let it meet a lot of different dogs. You know, you have to socialize your dog just like you socialize a person, you know, and if that has a great influence on how the dog behaves down the line. So if you take a dog and you tie it up a chain in the backyard, it's not going to do well in the world, no matter what kind of dog it is. You know, that dog is only going to know the backyard. It's only going to know the people that come. So anytime something new comes along, that dog is going to have fear and anxiety. And usually the way the dog deals with fear and anxiety is to lash out. So, I mean, that's true of any dog. At the same time, I mean, there is, you know, the fighters always talk about this quality called gameness, which is the willingness to fight. And, you know, there are some dogs without being abused or anything else that are more game, that have more of that sort of terrier prey instinct, and you know, when they get around another dog or another animal, they have that instinct to go for them. And so, I mean, that does exist, you know, and so it's part, one of the real messages of the book is that every dog's an individual. You know, you have to look at them individually and sort of judge them individually and understand them individually. And so you have to know if you have a dog that has that instinct, you know, you're going to make sure you keep that dog on the leash, and you're going to control the situations, and you're going to do what you can to socialize it as best you can to make sure, you know, it minimizes that instinct. So, you know, that does exist, but at the same time, you know, it doesn't mean that all pit bulls want to fight. And even like we saw with this case, you know, pit bulls that are raised in a dogfighting operation and put into those situations and where everything possible is done to make them want to fight, there's still many, many of them that won't or don't want to or have no interest in it. And that's one of the revelations that came out of this case. You know, it's just not as simple as taking two pit bulls and throwing them in a ring and they go after each other. You know, that's not necessarily true.
I find it really challenging, I have to confess, to drum up much empathy for Michael Vick and his associates in all of this. But I was shocked to learn that by the time he was, what, like 8 or 9, he had seen his first dog fight. That, to me, sounds tantamount to child abuse.
Yeah, that's what he has said. You know, in interviews, I haven't spoken directly to Michael Vick. He wasn't available for interviews when I was working on the book. But he has given interviews since in which he said that he saw his first dog fights at 7, 8 years old. And, yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, that's sort of horrific, you know. And a lot, you know, big deal was made recently about he gave that quote in an interview in GQ where he said, you know, he didn't understand why people made such a big deal out of it in a sense. I mean, I'm paraphrasing a little bit. But that, you know, that sort of goes right back to that same mentality. I mean, he grew up around it, you know. For him, you know, it was like if all of a sudden they started throwing people in prison for running stop signs or something. You know, I mean, it was that common where he grew up. And, you know, they've done studies where they've shown that people who are exposed to this at any level, you know, you become desensitized to violence. You know, there's higher rates of spousal abuse, higher rates of child abuse amongst people who not even participate in dogfighting, but just attend dogfights. Hmm. So, you know, there he is attending dogfights at age 8, you know, or 9, whatever it is, you know, happening in the courtyard right outside the apartment he lived in. You know, so you could see how you become desensitized to it. And you turn around someday and you think, you know, this is not, you know, what's wrong with this. Although I always want to point out when I get into this conversation that, you know, if you buy 15 acres and you have the dogs chained up deep in the woods and you have sheds that you've painted all black, including the windows, so they're not visible from the road.
You know you're doing
something
wrong. On some
level, you know you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing, you know. And when you've got a $130 million contract and you're a public figure, at some point you have to think to yourself, should I be doing this? You know, so as much as I want to understand Michael Vick and how he ended up where he ended up, at the same time, you know, I'm not willing to let him off the hook because he clearly knew it was not right.
Is this a big money industry?
You know, it's hard to pin that down. You know, the stories you hear about some of the betting are high numbers, you know, tens of thousands of dollars that are bet on individual fights. And I think if, you know, they say if you sort of end up with what they call a grand champion dog, you can get a lot of money for breeding or for selling pups from that dog. But I don't know how much of a money game it is or not. I mean, I'm sure there are at the real highest levels of it some people, you know, who make money off it. But, you know, it seems to be a combination of it's just a cultural sort of hobby, as much as I hate to use that word in association with it, sort of thing. That people just get into and do.
Well, we will learn the rescue portion of this story after this quick break. My guest this hour is Jim Grant. He's senior editor at Sports Illustrated and author of the book The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jim Grant. He's a senior editor at Sports Illustrated and author of the book The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Jim, these animals were recovered from the Vick compound. From the beginning, there were people who said, wait, let's step back here and see if we might be able to spare the lives of even a handful of them. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, it wasn't just a few people. I mean, it was enormous public outcry, which is really what did the trick. I mean, the federal prosecutor in charge of the case, his office was inundated with emails and letters and phone calls, you know, from the public just saying, hey, is there anything you can do? Give these dogs a chance. You know, people really felt bad. And you know, one of the great things about the book was that it documented the first time that these dogs were viewed as a victim. You know, oftentimes in these cases with dog fighting and pit bulls in particular, you know, the dogs are viewed as part of the crime, almost like the gun in a shooting. But this was the first time, really, that people looked at them as victims of this practice rather than participants in it. And that was a turning point moment for the breed, hopefully. But this huge public outcry took place, and the prosecutor was an open-minded kind of person who actually stepped back and said, well, you know, what are the possibilities? What can we do here? And the ASPCA had already been involved in some of the investigative part of the case, and they were approached and they put together a plan. At the same time, some sort of outside rescue groups had put together a similar plan, and those things were all sort of combined and acted on eventually.
And everybody was sensitive to the fact that as much as they wanted to spare the lives of these dogs, if possible, they needed to know they could work with them because they really didn't want any people getting hurt.
Right. I mean, absolutely. That's the ultimate guideline. You don't want to put a dog back out there that's then going to do some sort of damage, especially one from a high-profile case like this, because what you're hoping to do is prove to the world that these dogs are, you know, can be good dogs and can be rehabilitated and rescued. And so you don't want to undo that, you know, with a dog that's not going to hold up to, you know, being able to live, you know, in the world. So they really put a lot of effort into it. And most of these experts said going into it, out of the 50 dogs or so that they were looking at, they were hoping maybe there were five that they could, you know, spare and find, you know, enough sort of salvageable personality left in there to rehab, you know.
So what happened? They developed a series of tests. Talk about what they were looking for with each individual dog.
Well, they're sort of temperament tests, is what they term them, and there are things just to determine how a dog's going to react in a variety of situations. And they really tried to push the envelope on the testing because, obviously, you want to replicate those real-world situations. And if there's going to be a problem, you want there to be to show up during the testing. So I think it was a bank of about 10 or 12 tests, everything from, you know, giving the dog food and also some sort of something it would really love, like, you know, a rawhide or something like that. And then going in and trying to take it away from them and see how they react. You know, put them in with other dogs, how they're going to react with other dogs, both, you know, of different and the same gender, and how those things, how they react. And so they're really just trying to get a sense both, you know, of how they react with people and also how they react with other animals, different situations, and get a sense of which dogs react well or not well, if there's any red flags that go up, and then determining, you know, which ones they could work with, how much different ones might need, and what was the potential for each dog.
And the overwhelming majority were deemed to be at least worthy of making the effort.
That's right. 47 dogs in the end were spared, you know, there's a couple of factors that go into that. One of them was right at the end, you know, the biggest problem they found, which was, you know, one of the great things about the lost dogs and writing the book was how many sort of surprising things there were that came out of this was, and one of them was that the biggest problem with most of these dogs was fear. You would think the biggest problem would be aggression or something like that, but most of these dogs were just so afraid. You know, through most of the tests, what they would just do is, they called them pancakes dogs, just lie flat on the ground and sort of put their head down, and they just try to pretend like it wasn't there. It just sort of hold on until it was over.
And some of them wouldn't come out of their crates for hours.
Wouldn't come out of their crates. Had to be pulled out of the crates and carried out of the crates, and just really, really fear, paralyzing fear was their biggest problem. And so some of those dogs, obviously that makes them in some degree as hard to work with or limits their potential as much as aggression. But, there were some other ones that were better than that. And when it came down to the end and trying to determine, which dogs would be spared or not, Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, a huge sanctuary out in Utah, stepped forward, and they were willing to take a large number of dogs. And in the end, I believe they took, it was 21. And now, had Best Friends not come forward, would they have been able to spare all, 47? I mean, there were 47 that they thought had some potential, but, they needed a really special situation, and Utah Animal Sanctuary was a special situation where these dogs could go and live long-term and really get the kind of, intensive rehabilitative treatment that they needed. So that was a factor in being able to save that many of them, certainly, but it was there, and it did, and that's how many of them were spared.
Where do you start with these guys? I mean, when they're so afraid and they might be aggressive and they have all kinds of issues and you can't know their exact history, what are the first things that people do to try and bring them into the world?
Well, going back to the point we made earlier, and is, one of the main sort of themes of the Lost Dogs, is that it's individual. You have to, and that's what they did. Even when they took 21 dogs to Best Friends, all 21 of those dogs that ended up at that same place were not treated the same. Mm-hmm. They did individual evaluations of each dog and found out where its problems and weaknesses were and started to work on them, developed individual plans for each one. At a very basic level, it's about, establishing trust and security and giving them a routine, the familiarity. Like most people, dogs, they need that routine. They like a routine, and then they can start feeling like, okay, I know what the situation is. I know what's going to happen. I can relax, just as a person would in a lot of ways, So, I mean, that's probably the first most basic thing. But, again, you need to look at each individual dog and see then beyond that, what are their specific needs. So that's what happened with most of these dogs, and that's probably why, there was a high degree of success.
Reading about the routines, I don't know if you have kids, but it's sort of the same thing you're told the first time you're raising an infant. Just keep things consistent, and then it'll be easier for everybody all the way around.
I wish I had written this book 10 years ago because, my kids are older now. And in the process of writing the book, obviously I did a lot of research. I read a lot of, books about dog behavior and about animal training. And I'm like, this is exactly like kids. I wish I had known this when my kids were younger. I think I would have done a better job.
So some of these dogs really have absolutely thrived. There are a number of them that are now living with families in what would be considered normal circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that was when I first, I originally wrote an article for Sports Illustrated, then the book came out of the article. And when I first started looking at the story, I had just come across a little thing that said that these dogs were up for rehabilitation. They're being rehabilitated and some were up for adoption. And I thought, well, what the heck does adoption mean? Like, how do you adopt a fighting pit bull? Like, is it going to live in a house with other dogs and with kids and this kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. And that was one of the questions that sort of drove me forward to look into the whole thing. And that is the case. There's a bunch of them out there that have been adopted, and they live with other pets in the house and kids and children, and are doing really, really well. And it's sort of amazing, to see.
We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who wants to know how the animals are tested after they've been rehabilitated to make sure that they'll do all right, say, around other kids and other animals in heightened anxiety situations. That is something that the rehabilitators were sensitive to.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of different ways. They're, obviously, on an ongoing, everyday basis, they're sort of tested and put in situations and exposed to as much as they can be exposed to. They are almost all of the ones that have been adopted, and I would need to check that for sure, take the canine good citizen test, which is another temperament test that they're given, there were some of them that by court order couldn't be adopted until they had passed that test. I'm not sure that all of them had that requirement, but I know at least some of them did. And then, of course, it's also very, very careful screening with these dogs. They weren't given to just anybody, the ones that were adopted. There were people who came in and spent time with the dogs. Their families spent time with the dogs. They went through a background screening process and, you know, obviously had a knowledge of how to deal with dogs and had other dogs before and, you know, also were willing to do what it was necessary to keep the dogs out of situations where there would be problems. So they approached it both, you know, by dealing with the dog and dealing with the adopters, potential adopters, and also a lot of them were put into foster situations in between where they, you know, with experienced dog handlers, if not outright dog experts, where they were sort of slowly rolled out into public access. So they took as many steps as they could to ensure that there wouldn't be incidents.
Can you tell us a little bit about Sweet Jasmine, who I guess was the cover dog in the 2008 article that you did for Sports Illustrated?
Yeah, cover. She's on the cover of the book, also on the cover of the Lost Dogs, and you know, she was just, for me, what really drew me to her was that, you know, she was almost in a way a metaphor for the whole situation, because she was a dog that was one of these pancake dogs, just sort of paralyzed by her fear, really to extreme level, to a point where she just, you know, when she was in the shelters waiting, you know, there was a period when they were in government custody, and then they were waiting, you know, to see whether the result of their evaluations, that they would be spared or not. And she was so overwhelmed by the shelter situation where they actually built, within her little kennel, they actually built a little tent out of a rope and a blanket just to cut down the influence even more, because she, just the sound of other dogs and people walking by were so paralyzing for her. You know, and when I met her, she was somewhere in between. I mean, she had made a lot of progress to a point where she would, I remember when I met her, I was, you know, outside of the house, and I sort of bent down and you know, not quite facing her and tried to be approachable. And, you know, just like you would expect a dog, if you spend time with dogs, they want to come over and check you out, and they sniff, and they, you know, they might lick your hand, and she could come so far, you know, she could approach you, but she wouldn't take that last step you expect. She wouldn't let you actually touch her. She wouldn't, you know, maybe lick you like you would expect another dog to. And so this sort of struggle, this internal struggle that she was going through was just visible on the surface, where she wanted to be like a normal dog. She wanted to do the things dogs did. That instinct was there, and that desire was there, but the fear was still enough there that she couldn't quite allow herself to. And so for me, she was really, you know, sort of a moving case, because it was very visible, you know, the impact of what she had been through, where, you know, she was so close to being what you hoped she could be, but yet couldn't quite get there and was fighting with it.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting because she really exemplifies the fact that this was not an easy, it wasn't like somebody decided that these dogs should be saved and then they went to good homes and everything was better. They've done well, but on really varied levels.
That's right. And, you know, we'll keep hitting the same nail, you know, over and over again, but it goes back to this idea that they are individual dogs. You know, they started out as the Vic dogs, you know, this group of 51 dogs, but then, you know, over the course of the book and over the course of their actual lives, you know, they become individual dogs, because that's the only way to view them.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Emily on the line in Denton. Hi, Emily.
Hi. My question is, were the dogs, or are dogs in general, viewed as pets by the people who attended and put on the dog fights?
How does that work, Jim?
Well, it varies. When you talk about dog fighting, it's hard to talk about in a very general sense. There are dog fighters who are, you know, maybe guys who walk down the street with their dogs and, hey, my dog's tougher than yours, and they take him out in an alley and they let him go at it. You know, that's sort of what they call the street level of dog fighting. Then there, above that, there might be what they call the hobbyist level, which is someone who maybe has maybe 5 or 10 dogs, and they have, you know, a little bit of an idea of how to train these dogs and, you know, breed them or whatever, and, you know, they are more casual fighters. And there's like this professional level, which Vic was at, where they have, you know, 50 or 60 dogs and they're breeding them and they're spending a lot of money to get certain dogs and they're, you know, participating in these high level, high money fights. So, you know, it's different at different levels. At that lowest level, it probably is your pet. And in some regard, you consider it your pet. But at the higher level, you know, it's not probably at that. Although, you know, one of the unfortunate things I had to do in researching this book was read some of these accounts of real dog fighters about their fights and their dogs. And one of the things that comes across is that how lovingly they talk about the dogs and how much they admire them and, you know, how sad they are when they lose and get injured or, you know, have to be killed because they're injured to the point where they can't, you know, it's cruel to try and keep them alive. And they always talk about them in these sort of very warm terms, and it's sort of this real disconnect, and you think, how could you say that, how much you like this dog when you're putting it through all this stuff? But it's one of those other weird sort of oxymorons that exists within this world where they do feel sort of an affection for the dogs, but yet they still participate in this activity. It's sort of odd to understand from the outside, but that seems to be what happens.
Did you feel like you needed to witness a dog fight to fully understand this story?
You know what? I don't think I could have. I don't know. I've never considered it, to be honest. I don't think I could do it.
Yeah. Okay, so talk about the people who wanted to take these dogs. Obviously, they were carefully screened to make sure that they had the ability and the skills to take care of these dogs. Did everybody go into it thinking this will work out, or were there people who still had some apprehension?
Well, I think the people who took the dogs thought the best was possible and went into it with the idea that they were going to make it work. So yeah, I think there was a lot of hope and positivity on their part. And, telling those stories was part of the great joy of this, too. I mean, as much as it's a book about dogs, it's a book about people, you know, and I think you come away with it really understanding, you know, what it takes and how hard it is and what these people gave up to try and help these dogs. And, you know, that's a huge part of the success of all this is, you know, not only who did it, but what they did and how dedicated and selfless they were in the process.
Jim Garant is with us. He's a senior editor at Sports Illustrated and author of the book The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. It's available now in trade paperback. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sports Illustrated senior editor Jim Garant. He's also the author of the book The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I wonder if you'll tell us a little bit about Johnny Justice, the dog who was renamed Johnny Justice, because he's a great example not only of the success of this effort, but also, sadly, as you reveal in the afterword, of the enduring bias that people have against the pit bull breed.
Yeah, Johnny's funny, you know, because he's such a sort of fun dog. He's a little barrel of of joy and huffiness. And
he's Hollywood cute, sort of, too.
But yeah, he's one of those dogs who sort of makes you smile when you see him. I was about to say, but he was a guy, you know, who had some issues coming out of it all, but adapted really quickly and was able to work through them. And he was adopted or first taken in and worked with by a guy named Chris Cohen out in San Francisco. And you know, Chris worked with him quite a bit, and he had a lot of success. And eventually, Chris adopted him, and they started doing therapy work actually. And about six or seven of the dogs have actually gone on and not just, you know, sort of done well for themselves, but have actually gone on to do therapy work. They're certified therapy dogs now. It's a whole certification process they go through for that. And, they're giving back a little bit now. So Johnny was doing that. He was working in a program called Paws for Tales, in which kids come into public libraries and they read to the dogs. And this is, I don't know if you've seen lately, there have been some headlines. There was a case up here in New York where there was a teenage witness, and in order to testify, I believe it was a sexual abuse trial, they let her have a dog in the witness stand with her because that was the only way she could feel comfortable enough and soothed enough in order to say what she needed to say. And so this program allows kids to read to the dogs, which for kids who are maybe shy or feel like they have a little problem reading in class, it allows them to sort of work through that with, you know, probably the most receptive audience you could find. And it's sort of a thing that's helpful. And, of course, it also, the idea of the dogs gets kids into the library in the first place and gets them reading. And so there's all these positive benefits of it. And so roughly once a month, Chris and Johnny would go into these libraries and read with the kids. And one of the libraries, there was a whole sort of system of libraries they worked in. And one of them, about a year ago, actually just decided to ban pit bulls. With no reason given, really, and Chris took exception to that and protested, and he wanted the Paws for Tails program to pull out completely. If the pit bulls can participate, then none of the dogs can participate, and, you know, to make a statement about this kind of bias. Obviously, Johnny had been doing this for a year and a half and very successfully, and there was another pit bull in the program that had been doing it for a while, and there were never any incidents or problems, but it was just this, you know, unsubstantiated fear, generalized fear about the breed that led to it. And Paws for Tails, the local chapter out there, refused to pull out of the program. And so Johnny and Chris quit. And so they're not doing it anymore, to the, you know, the net loss for everyone involved, simply because people are unwilling to confront these biases about these breeds.
And there are organizations specifically set up to remind the world that dogs need to be taken on an individual basis and that pit bulls need not be feared as a whole if they are sensitively raised and cared for.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of rescue groups out there and advocacy groups that work specifically with pit bulls and try and set the standard. One, Chris actually works through a group called Bad Rap out in Oakland, California, and they took in 10 of the Vic dogs and then subsequently adopted them all out. And they, you know, they're some of the leading advocates, and they really do a good job of getting the word out there through their website and through a lot of appearances they do, and just trying to help fight that image and change that image and, you know, save as many dogs as they can.
So how permanently did the Vic case change the way subsequent cases of dogfighting are handled in terms of the ways in which the dogs are dealt with?
Well, it's been a huge change. I mean, we spoke earlier on several levels about, you know, the PETA and the Humane Society originally were sort of in favor of euthanasia, and that, as I said, had been the official policy of both organizations, but in the wake of this case, the Humane Society has changed its policy now, and they support individual evaluations and attempting to save as many dogs as possible. And so that's their official policy now, and that's more commonly the case now in any dogfighting situation. So that's change. This perceptive change we talked about, where people now view these dogs as victims rather than as perpetrators, and that's been a change ongoing. And then on the law enforcement level, you know, police, I think, learned through this case that these were good cases. A, they could get convictions, that they were gateway crimes. You know, when you busted a dog fight, you often found drug traffickers and gun traffickers and people who were not up to good things in a lot of other aspects of their lives. So it was a way to cut off several levels of crime through pursuing one particular kind of crime. So there's been an uptick in investigations into dogfighting. There's been a couple of really large busts. One that's called the St. Louis bust 2 years ago, and it was went across five states, and I think it was, I forget how many people, but more than 500 dogs. And so there's definitely been an uptick in enforcement, and you know, it's all for the better. And hopefully, there's less people. Out there doing it now because they've sort of heard about it and gotten the word that this is not something you can just get away with like you did in the past, that people aren't going to turn a blind eye to it anymore. So that's not measurable, but hopefully it's out there and having an impact.
You know, it's funny because I hate the thought of this case ever happening in the first place, but I wonder if it had not been Michael Vick, but John Doe, who was convicted of dog fighting in 2007, if that awareness would not have been raised, if it would have been sort of a local case and people wouldn't have talked about it in the way they did with this case.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned the paperback has a new afterword, and I think that I wrote that in there, you know, that in this sort of odd way, an unexpected way, Michael Vick might be the best thing that ever happened to the pit bull, you know, because, you know, he definitely shined a light on this. It was something that happened sort of in the dark corners that nobody thought much about or did a whole lot about, and that has definitely changed, and hopefully it will continue to go that way.
We have an email here from Betsy who writes, there are several breeds of dogs that are known to be aggressive, but it seems that if a mixed breed dog bites a person, even if it's part Labrador, it's classified as a pit bull. I've had an adopted pit bull around my children. He was the most loyal dog I've ever had. What can be done to rehabilitate their image?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's one of these things, one of these painful ironies about this, that so many dogs are misclassified. When there's an incident, you know, any dog with sort of shortish hair or, you know, a square-looking head, it's like, oh, it's a pit bull immediately. So on top of, you know, the biases that already exist, they're also blamed for things that they're not necessarily responsible for. And what exactly a pit bull is, and, you know, is a sort of a shadowy area and causes as much confusion and also contributes to these ongoing biases. As far as what could be done, I mean, I think, you know, hopefully telling stories like this, like the Lost Dogs Tales, will help you know, as much as people complained about seeing Michael Vick back in the limelight and making all this money and whatever, you know, his continued presence as a public figure, I think every time he's out there, people think about it. It forces people to continue to think about dogfighting, and hopefully that has an impact. And then otherwise, I think, you know, people out there who have pit bulls, like, you know, every time a family goes to a shelter and they come with a pit bull, you know, even if it's just 10 people in their neighborhood that meet that dog, and realize, hey, that's a great dog, and it's a pit bull, and, you know, there can be a great dog out there, a great family dog that is a pit bull, you know, almost on a grassroots level, just changing minds sort of one dog at a time, you know, and getting those dogs out of the hands necessarily only of people who have bad intent, which is how the pit bull's reputation went down so much to start with, and getting them more into the hands of people who have good intent and, you know, sort of undermining this mythology. Is probably, you know, not the fastest way, but the best way to make it happen.
Given the huge amount of money that an NFL star is worth, not to himself, but to his team and to the industry, were you not surprised to see him get this other $100 million contract that he's got now?
No, not after the way he played last year. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was absolutely brilliant on the field last year. You know, one of the other points I had to make in the afterward is that, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, the difference between, you know, everybody likes to talk about Michael Vick's retribution or, you know, redemption, but that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you don't redeem what you did off the field by what you do on the field. You know, playing good football doesn't make up for being a bad person. So there seems to be a lot of confusion about that, or people assuming one goes with the other. I don't, and I don't think you should. You know, what he's doing off the field in terms of the speaking engagements he's doing in the Humane Society and some of the other stuff like that, and he has recently said he wants to be part of the solution, and if he can continue to do that, then, you know, that's how he redeems himself, not by throwing touchdown passes. And, you know, yeah, he can make a good living by throwing touchdown passes, but that's not the ultimate goal.
Were you able to get to a place where you felt like you could evaluate the veracity of his claims that he was sorry for what he did?
No. Mm-hmm. No, I have no idea. I think the only way we'll know is, you know, when we know. Sometimes when asked this, I say, you know, dogfighting will be a part of Michael Vick's obituary.
Yeah.
Whether it's the first line, whether it's the majority of it, whether it's a paragraph somewhere in the middle, that depends on what he does with the rest of his life. But we won't know until then. You know, right now he's saying the right things, he's doing the right things, but he's got to continue to do those, you know, going forward. And then at the end, you can look back and say, hey, he was true to his word. But until that point, nobody knows.
Did he deserve a second chance?
It's hard to say no. You know, when you've sort of written a book about these dogs that were given a second chance, it's hard then to turn around and argue that the person doesn't deserve the same. You know, there is a part of it that's hard to see him prosper. you know, when he sort of inflicted so much harm. And but at the same time, you know, you got to believe in the criminal justice system. You know, he was caught, he stood trial, he was given a sentence, and he served his time. So, you know, it's hard to say that he doesn't.
What have you heard from people who were and are fans of Michael Vick who've read the book? Has anybody changed their minds? I mean, I'm curious about their response in particular.
You know, it's varied. It's varied. I've met people, a lot of people who are Eagles fans who say, I still root for the team, but just not for him. You mm-hmm. know, I've met people who they sort of get angry because they don't want to have to deal with it. That, hey, he went to jail. It's over. Move on. Let it go. I've gotten accusations that it's racially motivated, and that if it was a white player, a book like this never would have been written. I've gotten some people who have absolutely, they were Eagle fans, and now they can't root for the team anymore. So it's sort of a full spectrum of reactions and no set pattern.
You had obviously not specialized in animal stories or animal rights stories before this. Has this remained sort of something that you want to stay involved in terms of your career?
No, you know, I think that's sort of the original Sports Illustrated article in the book. I think sort of that is what made both of them work. It was obvious that I was not an advocate from either side of it. I was sort of an outsider
just
who was trying
guy.
To just figure out the truth. And mm-hmm. I think that made it more powerful. And I've sort of since then, although you're certainly around it a lot, you know, the whole animal welfare movement, and certainly willing to lend a hand where you can, you know, appearances, I've donated probably 100 books, signed copies of the book that to various shelters who could then auction them off to help support their causes, and more than willing to do that. But I've worked hard not to become part of the animal rights movement necessarily, because as a journalist, you know, you never want to get sort of that far into what you're dealing with. So while you know, I'm in support of what they do, I have not become a part of it myself.
So obviously you tried to approach all of this with an open mind, but I wonder if you can talk just briefly about the things that surprised you most as you investigated.
Well, some of the things we talked about, just these contradictions about the dogs where, you know, you thought they would be aggressive, but they were afraid, you know. Other things you thought, you know, like for me at least, I thought they would have problems with other dogs, but for most of them, they were way more comfortable around other dogs and afraid of around people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were lots of sort of surprises like that. Some of the other surprises was just what the people went through, the people who eventually adopted some of the dogs or fostered them and worked with them,
yeah.
The rehabilitation, how intense it was and how much they gave of themselves to do it. I mean, I think those stories that are told in The Lost Dogs, for me, The level of that was sort of surprising.
I'm going to have to jump in. We're out of time. Jim Gurant's new book is called The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. Jim, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.